Large Marge stormed behind the service counter and came back out carrying a 12-gauge riot pump. It had no buttstock, just an electrician's tape-wrapped pistol grip. The ancient Stevens looked like it had been cut down with a hacksaw by a 7-year-old. There was no bluing left on the barrel or receiver.
Everybody get down on the floor! I'm gonna blow up this asshole!
Rupert and the other customers scrambled for cover, tipping over more tables and chairs as the guy in the t-shirt marched up the wheelchair access ramp leading to the roadside cafe's front door. Though Rupert was a corrections officer, he was unarmed. He worked minimum security at the county jail. Large Marge stood with her massive legs spread apart, the scattergun's crude pistol butt braced upward on the point of her wide hip, her finger resting on the trigger. Only when a shadow appeared behind her did Rupert remember the other guy who got out of the car. By then, it was too late. Large Marge jolted forward as if she'd been snap-kicked low in the back. The bib of her grease-stained apron exploded outward, sending glistening red chunks hurtling across the room. The 12-gauge boomed in her hand. She dropped to both knees on the floor, jaw gaping, eyes wide with shock. The hem of her faded flower-print dress was scrunched up, revealing the nylons rolled down around her swollen ankles. The second guy in black stepped up behind her and put the muzzle of a silenced assault rifle to the back of her head. Both of the psychos were in serious bodybuilder shape. Not an ounce of fat on either of them. Short hair, clean-shaved, tanned, they had a military bearing. And they killed almost nonchalantly, like breathing in and breathing out. Were they whacked-out neo-Nazis from Idaho, Rupert wondered? No, he decided. He couldn't see any swastika or Aryan Nation tattoos. The tats he could see were weird. They both had the same one on the inside of their forearm. A black silhouette bat with wings spread over a stylized globe. Maybe they were part of some psycho-killer vampire cult?
All of you, get in the corner! Crawl!
He had a funny accent, as if he were gargling marbles. Then it dawned on the Clallam Bay corrections officer who the guys were and where they were from. They were Russians off the grounded sub. Rupert tried to make himself as small as possible behind the overturned table. No mean feat. No one stepped forward to speak up for the hostages, or for themselves for that matter. Under the circumstances, it was understandable. The man kneeling right next to Rupert was a lanky guy in lager bib fronts, rubber boots, and a long john top. He had a hinky, wild look in his eyes, like a squirrel caught in a live trap. Rupert knew the fool was going to make a break for it, knew it was going to be suicide, but he didn't say anything, and he didn't reach out to stop him. The second black shirt made a precision pivot from his hips, a narrow arc that brought the sights of his assault weapon in line with the running man. This was no dinky machine pistol. It fired high-velocity rounds, tumblers. As they penetrated, they didn't just cut holes, they carved slots in bone, muscle, and organ. The logger never even made it to the service counter.
Are you shut now the fucking up?
Rupert's heart stopped as the logger hit the floor, then leaped at the sound of a siren. There was a state patrol station about a mile up the hill. The cavalry was coming. While the second guy guarded the hostages at gunpoint, the other one stepped back out through the front door. None of the huddled captives could see what was going on from their position on the floor in the back corner. Rupert figured the state patrol car stopped on the far side of the Russians' roadblock.
Yeah.
The state trooper was opening up big time on the Russian.
Get him. Get him.
The pistol stopped firing.
Just be reloading. Just be reloading.
When Grimaldi banked the helicopter hard, the G-Force woke up Lyons. He rubbed his face with both hands, then pulled on his intercom headset.
What's up?
Lyons looked out the aircraft's wraparound front window. They were flying over the strait, heading west, more than a mile offshore.
Where are we? We've got a new destination, Iron Man. Port Angeles is a no-go. What happened?
Apparently there's been a bio or chemical weapon release on the hook. It's related to the sub beaching. Could be an accident, could be a planned attack, but it's looking more and more like an attack.
There are mass casualties on the ground. Two choppers have already crashed, one Coast Guard, one Navy, with no survivors. Stony Man thinks whatever was released from the sub caused the crashes. The pilots must have gotten dosed or infected as they circled over the site.
They didn't have protective suits on board?
Neither do we. Only Navy hazmat has those, and they just landed on the hook. hook.
So, what are we into here? Hard to say at this point. Everything's still fluid. We've been ordered to give Port Angeles a wide berth. We're going farther west to check out a possible landing by personnel from the Russian sub. Stony Man tracked three wave skimmers running ashore before the ship grounded itself. An apparent carjacking with a homicide took place in the area where Bear figures they came ashore. The cowboy thinks they could be Spetsnaz, and that they could be carrying additional stocks of the weapon that was released on the hook. This isn't exactly a sneak attack, is it?
Just the opposite. It guarantees maximum media coverage.
As the entrance to Port Angeles Bay came up on the left, Grimaldi banked the helicopter again, heading upwind, moving even farther out over the straits and climbing to an altitude of 2,000 feet. All patrol aircraft were pulled away to a safe distance. Lyons picked up a pair of image stabilizer binoculars and looked southwest. He could see huge fires burning out of control in downtown Port Angeles. Skipperless boats bobbed along the bay shoreline, some of them run aground. There were bodies strewn around the Coast Guard air station hangar and down the length of the hook. Firefighters, EMTs, police, SEALs, and civilians. The only sign of life was the hazmat team. They were walking on the landing strip in moon suits. Even from 2 miles out, the Russian sub looked enormous.
We just got word of a 911 request from the town of Squim that may be connected to the shore party. It's a home invasion robbery. The responding officer is down. There are multiple civilian fatalities.
What makes you think this has anything to do with the sub?
A Toyota truck belonging to a homicide victim from Freshwater Bay is parked at the scene. We also have an unconfirmed report of a Russian-made suppressor-equipped assault weapon.
We're on our way!
Turning a tight 180, they were heading back the way they'd come.
The Squim PD is stretched very thin. A skeleton crew is all that's left there. The rest are helping man the roadblocks outside Port Angeles. The Bureau has personnel on the ground. They just arrived.
And if Russians from the sub are involved?
Pick up the trail and hunt them down. We have to assume they've got more of the bioweapon and that they intend to use it. They have to be found and neutralized before they reach Seattle or Tacoma, or the people in those cities will die, all of them, within hours. This stuff is more lethal than anything I've seen in all my years of service. Be smart, as always, but take these bastards out.
Talk about needle in a haystack. We don't know how many opposition there are. We don't know what their primary target is. We don't know if they have sleepers already in position to give them tactical support. We don't know if they're suiciders.
Do you get the feeling the wheels are coming off?
If that's the case, we're gonna screw them back on.
Squim, Washington sat nestled in the rain shadow of the Olympic Mountains. From the base of the Olympic foothills, broad, sloping meadowlands stretched to the shoreline of the strait. Able team flew along the water at 1,500 feet until they got close to their destination, then they turned inland. Grimaldi angled across the narrow two-lane road that paralleled the strait.
That's it, ahead!
They approached a cluster of buildings in a tree-bordered meadow. He circled the target location. The sprawling two-story house must have been at least 5,000 square feet. The RV garage and the barn were two stories, too. A Toyota pickup, two Squim PD cruisers, and a black Ford Crown Victoria without a light bar were parked on the long horseshoe driveway. A hatless man in a cop uniform was bent over double, leaning on the front bumper of the Crown Vic. He didn't look up as their aircraft began to descend. Grimaldi set the chopper down in the pasture next to the barn. As they hopped the split rail fence and started up the driveway, an FBI agent came barreling out of the double front doors and down the flagstone stairs. He had on a dark blue nylon windbreaker with big block letters in yellow on the back. His bill cap had the same lettering embroidered across the front, FBI. The untrimmed, adjustable plastic hat strap stuck out a good 3 inches from the side of his head, which made his skull seem a lot smaller than it was and gave him a decidedly goofy look. He came at them with his arms spread, palms out.
Let's not forget what Kate said about making waves.
Hey, we're the big dogs in this yard. If we don't lean on their buttons, they'll know something's fishy.
Makes sense to me.
The Bureau's got everything covered, gentlemen.
The agent held out his arms to gather them in and block their path to the house.
No need for you to be here. You have much more pressing matters on your plates this morning.
We have to take a look. It's our job.
Sorry, I can't let you do that. No one goes in the house until after our crime scene techs get through processing it. That's Bureau standard procedure in a homicide.
And when are your techs gonna show up?
Frankly, I have no idea. Sorry.
Don't be.
Before he knew what to do, the unhappy FBI agent was bringing up the rear. When they got to the Crown Vic, the squim cop was still bent over the bumper. His face was ashen. Strands of bile draped over the toes of his black brogues.
You okay, buddy? Sit down a minute. Get your breath.
The special agent paid no attention to the local cop. He rushed into the house to warn his fellow agents that DHS was coming. Grimaldi stayed outside to help the officer while Lyons led the others up the stairs, through the double doors, and into the wide flagstone foyer. On the right, it opened onto a sunken great room with a skylighted two-story ceiling and a wall lined with long, narrow windows to catch the afternoon sun. Another wall was covered by an enormous stone fireplace. The plaster was pocked with lines of bullet holes. Some of the windows were shot out.
Ugh!
It reeked like a cross between a slaughterhouse and a shooting gallery. The four agents stood in a row at the end of the foyer, presenting a unified front and a wall of bodies between Able Team and the rest of the murder house. They were all wearing the field jackets. They had powder blue protective booties over their street shoes and white latex gloves on their hands. A rangy, bald-headed guy stepped forward. His official bureau windbreaker was so fresh from the package, it still had rectangular creases in the front.
You were told to stay out of here.
Couldn't do that. We've got our orders, too.
The bald special agent in charge glanced at their ID tags, a token check, as if he couldn't be bothered reading their names.
Have you ever been through a crime scene before?
He didn't say, "You DHS turkeys," but it was there in his tone.
We've seen a few.
Well, this one's a real mess. Multiple gunshot homicides. I can't have you puking all over my evidence.
If we have to hurl, we promise to swallow it.
Is that supposed to be funny? We drove up here all the way from the Tacoma branch. This is our crime scene.
This was your crime scene. Face the facts. You can't stop us. We're going through the scene whether you like it or not. If you're that worried about the integrity of the evidence, give us your booties and gloves. Come on, make it snappy. We're on the clock here, agent.
The SAC's face flushed with hot blood. The look in his eyes said he wanted to give the trio of Johnny-come-lately glory grabbers a piece of his mind. It said he wanted to defend the Bureau's turf by protesting the intrusion up the chain of command. But in the new pecking order, all that was a waste of breath.
Go on. Give him your booties and gloves. FBI, stay put.
Lyons led his teammates down into the great room. The furniture was shot up, as well as the walls and windows. Gaudy and expensive hand-blown glass lamps were blown to pieces. The stuffing was knocked out of leather-upholstered armchairs. There were scads of empty shell casings scattered on the off-white Berber carpet. Lyons bent down and picked one up.
Son of a fucking bitch!
5.45, Russian.
Blunkenellis and Schwartz crossed to the other side of the room and stood over a dead uniform cop. At the foot of the two-story high wall, he was face up in a puddle of dark, sticky blood soaked into the carpet. His blue steel Beretta 92 lay where he dropped it, inches from his outstretched hand. There were multiple bullet impacts to his body armor. He was hit on the left arm and took a rifle slug to center face. The 5.45mm Russian round had a specially designed hollow tip that deformed on impact, making the bullet tumble, which created a devastating destruction track and a keyhole-shaped exit wound. The back of the officer's head was gone. It hit the wall behind him, along with a plume of brains and blood. Across the wide room, on a built-in conversation pit couch, another body lay sprawled on its side. Presumably, it was one of the perps. He was a big, sandy-haired guy in black t-shirt and black jeans, late 20s. His eyelids were half-closed, his face slack in death, the mouth drooping from the pull of gravity.
Look at that tat.
He reached down and turned the dead man's forearm into view. It was a stylized black vampire bat with spread wings covering a stylized globe.
Looks like Cowboy was right.
The Spetsnaz sailor had a significant gunshot wound to the upper left quadrant of his chest. The exit track came out through his right shoulder blade. But what killed him was a high-velocity, close-range gunshot to the base of the neck. With both hands, Lyons carefully lifted the dead man's head. The bullet through and throughed into the bloody couch cushion. The Spetsnaz was already down when he got shot.
Maybe it was a mercy bullet, coup de grace?
Check out this dropped piece.
Blunkenellis pointed at the rug on the other side of an end table. Lyons and Schwartz joined Blunkenellis.
We've never seen anything like that. We're going to have to send that weapon to Firearms Division for identification.
That won't be necessary. It's a Russian AKS-74U shorty assault rifle. 8-inch barrel, 30-round plastic mag, with PBS silencer and BS-1 silent underbarrel grenade launcher.
The 74 shorty is one deadly little package. With the stock folded up, it's the size of a machine pistol. But it has a mil-spec rifle cartridge wallop. We're talking about 2.5 times the muzzle velocity of a 9mm Parabellum round.
Very interesting.
Is this all of it?
No, there's plenty more bodies. The homeowners got themselves killed, too. Come this way.
The special agent led them to the other side of the house and the laundry room. The door was open, and 5 people were dead on the quarry tile floor. 4 of them were senior citizens. The 5th was a very short, dark-skinned Latina in her 30s. All were headshot at close range from the rear, execution style. Their wrists were taped behind their backs. High-velocity spatter clung to the tile walls and ceiling, the front of the washer and dryer. Laundry hanging up on an interior clothesline was no longer clean. From the spray pattern, it looked as if they had been shot on their knees.
Who were they?
According to the next-door neighbor, there were 2 full-time residents, 2 guests, a live-in cook and maid.
How many perps were involved?
Unknown. The neighbor saw a couple of the family cars pull away. He couldn't see inside them.
How long ago was that?
15 minutes.
Have you got an APB out on them?
Not yet. We're still trying to get the model and license plates from Washington State DMV.
Let's talk to the neighbor.
We've already got all his information.
Well, we don't now, do we?
The house next door was a modest late 50s bungalow on a small lot. The postage stamp front yard was surrounded by a low chain link fence. Inside the fence was an elaborate and cluttered miniature garden, complete with droves of ceramic gnomes and rabbits. Concrete bird baths decorated with mosaic tile and a couple of fish ponds with tiny electrically powered waterfalls. As Lyon started to open the gate in the fence, an old guy in an electric golf cart whirred down the driveway at high speed. He had on a straw Panama hat and thick lens aviator-style glasses. The thin, clear plastic oxygen line was looped over his head and clipped onto his nostrils. The oxygen tank sat on a bench seat beside him.
You guys are Homeland Security? Is what happened next door connected with that mess over in PA?
That's what we're looking into now, sir.
Did you call the police?
Yeah, around 8 a.m. I was out back watering my rose bushes. I saw some guys in a Toyota pickup pull up the driveway. White guys. They broke in through the front door. Cop car showed up at 8:15.
How many guys got out of the truck?
I couldn't see them too well. I was looking through the tree branches along the property line. Right after the cop went in, I heard a couple of pistol shots. I'd have gone over there myself, but I'm kind of bunged up these days.
Lying across the rear platform of the golf cart was a scoped Remington 7400 semi-auto rifle with a leather shoulder sling. A 270 caliber. The checkered walnut grips of a government Colt 45 hooked over the waistband of the old man's yellow and white plaid golf slacks.
You're loaded for bear there, sir.
Haven't used the rifle since my lungs went to hell. I brought the sidearm home from Korea as a souvenir. Figured, what with all the Russian crap going on in PA, I'd better be prepared. I killed commies when I was in the army. They were Chinese, though. Are the Weavers okay? They're nice people. Rich, but not stuck up. Retired from Los Angeles. Had some relatives visiting them from down south.
What happened after you heard the pistol shots?
A few minutes later, the garage door opened up and some cars roared down the driveway.
How many?
2 cars. Weavers have 3 if you count the Suburban.
The SUV's still there. I saw it.
They have a gold Maxima sedan and a white Volvo station wagon. Both of them are 1 year or 2 old. You didn't say if they were all right.
Well, thanks for your help, sir. You can put your guns away now. Everything's under control.
When they got back to the entrance of the murder house, the FBI agents were ganged up on Grimaldi. The Stony Man pilot looked faintly amused by it all.
This is an emergency. We're all on the same team here.
What's going on?
We're all on the same team now.
Grimaldi carefully inspected the unlit end of his stub of a cigar.
We just picked up an officer needs assistance call from a state trooper. There's a shootout in progress down at Large Marges in Discovery Bay, about 10 miles east of here on 101. It's a major incident. Automatic weapons, grenades, multiple fatalities, hostages. Got the highway blocked off in both directions with wrecked cars and trucks. Sounds like the same guys who did this have moved their act down the road.
Could be our boys.
Most definitely our boys. What's Large Marges?
It's a funky restaurant at the end of Discovery Bay, right on 101.
Big chainsaw sculptures out front of a fat lady and giant hamburger.
Not ringing any bells. What does the Bureau want from us?
Give us a ride to the action over there. You've got room in the chopper. We can be your backup.
Sorry, no can do. This is a job for Homeland Security.
The SAC's face went all red again.
What? You're turning down our help?
The second question was shouted at their backs as they ran for the split rail fence.
Iron Man, you went and did it. You really pissed off those feds. The SAC was hopping mad. Pop-up blood vessel mad.
This is Russian Special Forces, not some pimple-faced jerk pirating DVDs in his basement. I just saved their lives.
After Able Team broke off the scrambled in-flight debriefing on the Squim murder house and the ongoing shootout at the Discovery Bay Cafe, Hal Brignola addressed the assembled Stonyman cyber unit.
The tattoo and the weaponry are confirmation that our hostiles are a Spetsnaz unit that came from the submarine, most likely on the three wave skimmers we tracked.
We know they've taken the lives of at least seven Americans so far this morning.
And the day is young. From the description of the shootout on 101, that number is going to go a lot higher.
They abandoned one of their crew at the Squim house. Safe guess is the cop shot him before he went down himself. Spetsnaz couldn't take the wounded guy with him, and they couldn't risk leaving him behind because of what he knew about the mission. So they executed him on the spot.
If there's a rational plan here, the point of it escapes me. It's like helter-skelter.
They're continuing to draw as much attention to themselves as possible. And you're right, Akira. They're acting like spree killers.
It's like they want to get caught, or they're taunting us in full view of the news cameras, daring us to stop them.
We know they're down one soldier, but we still don't know how many are left.
We know there are at least two, because there are two missing vehicles from the Squim house.
They left the stolen Toyota pickup at the scene. They changed vehicles to throw off pursuit, and so they could divide their force and increase the chances of accomplishing their mission, whatever that is.
Do we have the carrying capacity of the wave skimmers?
According to the Russians, they hold a maximum of two passengers.
A total of six possible hostiles.
But as few as three in the landing party, and one is dead, which would leave us just a pair.
There were two cars taken from Squim. That could mean there are two Spetsnaz left. Or maybe it's just supposed to look like there are just two left?
My guess is they intended to lay low at the Squim house for a while. With all the hubbub in Port Angeles, they didn't count on that uniformed cop showing up so quickly.
Either that, or they're just making it up as they go, guerrilla style.
They could all be holed up in the restaurant right now. Wouldn't that be sweet?
Sweet, but not very likely. Why did they pick that particular restaurant?
Maybe something went wrong? Maybe one of the cars they stole broke down. Maybe they got into an accident on 101. There's no way to tell. As it stands, we've got no eyes and ears on the ground.
We won't get any either, not until Abel has the situation under control.
The hostage taking could be a diversion by part of the Spetsnaz team, meant to draw attention away from the others, intended to sow more confusion among the pursuit and panic among the general population. That would buy time for the remainder of the unit to get into position in a population center.
Are they carrying a bioweapon?
We won't know what they have until they release it, or until Able Team sorts through the bodies at the scene.
Better they turn it loose in Discovery Bay, population maybe 75 people, than Seattle or Tacoma with millions.
They haven't threatened to use a bioweapon so far.
They haven't made any attempts to communicate with the state troopers and county sheriffs on the scene. No demands, no public proclamations, no manifestos, nothing like that.
Even if it turns out the hostage takers at the restaurant don't have this Red Frost bioweapon, it doesn't prove anything. The Spetsnaz soldier, still on the loose, if there are others, would be the ones transporting the weapon and tasked with deployment against specific high-value targets.
Well, thanks to our new Russian email buddies, we've got details of the weapon's appearance and likely applications. The weaponized bacteria is sealed in glass vials, along with nutrients. They melt the ends of a glass cylinder and draw them into closed points at each end. The high temperature creates a vacuum inside the container that keeps the bacterial spores in hibernation mode. The vials are about the size of a cigar tube.
How many people can one of them infect?
The number is unlimited. Each of the vials could contain millions of the microscopic spores. Theoretically, just a few of them could lead to the kind of awful death we saw in the live video feed. As the bacteria infects, it reproduces, rapidly making more copies of itself outside and inside the victim. According to the Russians, once inside a victim, it secretes a chemical that causes the body to attack its own collagen. After it's released into an environment, it spreads via person-to-person contact, inhalation, ingestion, and through breaks in the skin.
The applications of this thing are off the chart. Take a dry day like today in Seattle and drop one of those vials from an overpass onto the freeway at rush hour. It would shatter on the road, and the cars and trucks driving through the dust would whip the bacteria into the air and transport it all through the city's central core along the highway. The commuters would carry the bacteria home to the suburbs with them.
It could also be taken up to the roof of a downtown skyscraper and broken there. A strong wind would lift it high into the atmosphere and spread it for miles across the city.
Well, this stuff is easily dispersed by any number of means. The only bright note is the death gene.
What?
Dr. Vorostov built in a genetic off switch. After a certain number of generations, the weapon stops reproducing and dies off. Otherwise, any place that was infected would never be habitable again.
We don't know that the designated target is the Pacific Northwest, but it stands to reason that it is because of the time element. The longer the renegade Spetsnaz are on the loose, the more likely it is they'll be caught and stopped.
The Russians sent us a potential target list, but it's 20 years out of date. It looks like the original list developed by the weapon designer. It isn't much, and the targets listed are all pretty obvious, but it's a starting point.
With our limited information, we can't advise the president to put out a code red alarm.
A code red would really be letting the cat out of the bag, and there'd be no getting it back. More to the point, what would a maximum security warning accomplish at this stage? People just got to work in the three most likely target states. All DHS can do is tell them to go back home and stay indoors. Panic and chaos is what these bad guys want. Clogged streets and freeways would make their weapon a whole lot more effective.
You're right. We don't have any of the specifics nailed down. We don't know what the mission's goal is.
What about the victims in Port Angeles?
The latest update is grim. Everyone downwind of the sub grounding is either dead or dying. The people on the outskirts of town, and those higher on the slopes of the foothills, seem to be doing okay for now. Navy hazmat medical personnel have taken over the local hospital. More federal and state decontamination teams are underway. The only good news is, the symptoms seem to be confined to the immediate Port Angeles area. There are no reports of illness to the west or to the east.
That is good news.
Are we being led down the garden path here by Spetsnaz? Could this spree business be a total misdirection? Up to this point, our hostiles have acted as if they have no resources to draw on. No sleepers in position to help them accomplish their mission. Hey, a sleeper agent could have just picked him up at Freshwater Bay with no one the wiser. No murder, no stolen truck. They could have gotten themselves to their target without risk of discovery, delivered the bioweapon, and then disappeared.
But they couldn't have spread the maximum amount of panic that way. Anticipated disaster is the key here. Anticipation and dread.
The lack of ground support does seem fairly unlikely given the complexity of the operation.
What do the good Russians have to say about that?
They say they are unable to provide us with information about sleepers at this time.
Unable or unwilling?
We have to take them at their word. They have as much at stake here as we do.
Maybe Abel can find something at the restaurant that will fill in some of the blanks.
Nah, don't get your hopes up, Carmen. These Russian Special Forces guys are well-trained and well-prepped. Just because we don't know what they're doing doesn't mean they don't.
Press the Russian intel source harder, Bear. In case they're holding back what they think they can get away with.
Assuming the Spetsnaz at the restaurant are carrying the bioweapon, how is Abel going to deal with it? They don't have protective gear. They're putting themselves at grave risk.
Don't worry about Abel. They'll find a way to get in and a way to get out. They always do.
We can't count on capturing any of the Spetsnaz alive. Essentially, the hostage taking at Discovery Bay is a suicide mission. Think about it. They've shut off the highway at a single point. The reinforcement routes by land, sea, and air still wide open. They've boxed themselves in. There's no way they're coming out of this alive.
It's another opportunity to draw media attention, and it exposes to the world the fact that the situation vis-a-vis the submarine incursion isn't anywhere near contained.
These conspirators don't care about engendering sympathy for their cause in the U.S. They don't even care enough to make their cause public. Why would they? We're the sworn enemy of their fallen nation. We're the reason for their suffering and humiliation.
Frankly, I don't think they give a damn about engendering sympathy in the former Soviet Union either. I think their goal is to force the respective government's hands through a single cataclysmic attack, thereby reviving the old Cold War suspicions and hostilities, and ultimately bringing about some reincarnation of the Soviet war machine.
And to turn back the hands of time, they're willing to take down hundreds of thousands of innocent people.
As Grimaldi skimmed the tops of the tall firs and spruce that bordered Highway 101, Lyons looked down on the two-lane road below. More than a mile from the scene of the shootout, traffic was already backed up in the southerly direction. Some cars at the end of the line were K-turning and heading back the way they'd come toward Squim. Other than that, there was no traffic coming north. Beyond the fringe of trees on the left, the hillside dropped 500 feet to the long, relatively narrow bay. Farther on, people were out of the stopped vehicles, a lot more people than there were cars and trucks to carry them. When Grimaldi followed the highway around a dogleg right turn, it became obvious what was going on. The downgrade that led to the bay was clogged with abandoned vehicles. They were parked on and off the road, left behind in haste, if not panic. The drivers and passengers hurried up the highway, around the bend, and out of the line of fire. Grimaldi overflew the state patrol station on the right and whipped down the grade. A mile ahead, the highway flattened out and curved around the end of the bay, where it necked down to nothing. The makeshift roadblock closest to them was a jumble of burning cars and trucks. A pall of greasy black smoke drifted over the mudflats of low tide. There were bodies on the highway as well, and sprays of glass from chain reaction rear-end collisions.
Goddamn mess.
Looks like Baghdad.
Climbing to 200 feet, Grimaldi did a quick flyby. As they hurtled south, Lyons took in the little commercial enclave nestled at the head of the bay. On the left of the highway was a kiddie park with a six-car, gaily painted antique passenger train. The right side of the road was shared by a shambling second-hand store, a chainsaw sculptor's workshop, a fish market in a rusting World War II metal Quonset hut, and a tiny drive-through espresso stand. On the far side of the espresso stand stood the red-sided single-story restaurant with cartoon figure statues out front. Just beyond the cafe, the highway forked. The left fork led up around the east side of the bay to Port Townsend. The right continued on to Hood Canal. The grassy hillside above the split in the road was dotted with a row of dollhouse motel cabins and a ramshackle Victorian farmhouse. As they swept by the restaurant, they passed over the overturned semi-trailer and the beige fan of wood chips across the road. Beyond, more cars were burning. Further on, more abandoned cars sat with shot-out windshields. Around the next bend, the local cops were out in force. There were more than a dozen squad cars and a couple of ambulances, all with lights flashing. Human-shaped forms lay on the road under sheets of bright yellow plastic. Road flares littered the pavement. The police were turning traffic around, sending it back towards Seattle. Grimaldi made a hard right turn, starting to circle back.
Whoa! That's incoming!
There was no gunshot report, just the slug's impact. Grimaldi dropped low and crossed over a vegetation-choked creek bed. He skirted the forested slope as he continued the spiral to the northwest. The fast, tight pivot prevented the sniper from getting off a second shot. At the top of the grade, the Stony Man pilot swung back over the highway, just to the west of the dogleg. He carefully set the chopper down in a clear-cut field on the side of the road. Lyons, Schwartz, and Bloncanalis exited the aircraft, lugging their fighting gear in padded cases. With Grimaldi bringing up the rear, they jumped onto the highway's shoulder and jogged downhill to the bottleneck bend. Motorists stood on the side of the road and sat inside their vehicles. Some looked dazed. A few were bleeding. The sight of Able Team seemed to give them a lift. Just before the highway made the right turn out of the kill zone, a lone state trooper was trying to contain an unmanageable situation. He was tall, young, ramrod straight, and clearly overwhelmed by what landed in his lap. He either lost or discarded his uniform hat.
Man, am I glad to see you guys. How many more of your people are coming?
For the time being, we're it.
Oh, man!
What's the situation?
I tried to move the civilians trapped between here and the pileup out of their cars and up the hill, but I'm not sure I got them all. I came under some heavy fire and had to pull back before I could check the vehicles at the front of the line. It just got too hairy.
How many hostages down at the restaurant?
I don't know. When I rolled on the scene, the shootout was already in progress. From the cars parked out front, there could be 15 or 20 people in there, counting the hired help? There's been no demands, no word from inside. They just keep shooting at anything that moves.
Do you know how many shooters?
It's hard to say. We're not hearing gunshots. There are no muzzle flashes either, but the bullets just keep whizzing past, real close. They're filing this way and down the highway in the other direction. They're using silencers.
So you've got no idea what the shooters took in with them?
The only people who saw that are the hostages inside the cafe, and they sure aren't talking. They could all be dead, couldn't they? We wouldn't have even heard the shots.
Say, are you hit?
Lyons was looking at the man's back. His uniform shirt was scorched, and there were horizontal tears in the fabric. His armored vest was showing through the rips.
No, just bruised, thanks to the trauma plate. I was the only one on duty up at the station when all hell broke loose down here. The rest of my unit was out west, helping deal with the situation in PA. I heard the first explosions and got down the hill as fast as I could. I arrived just in time to get grenaded. Man, oh man, I've never been through anything like that. Blew the holy hell out of my cruiser, but I'd already bailed. The blast and shrapnel knocked me down, but I was lucky. It didn't knock me out, and I just managed to crawl to cover before the shooter could finish me off.
Who's on the far side of the restaurant?
There's Jefferson County sheriffs and city cops from Port Townsend. They drove around on 104 to come up on the south side of 101. All available personnel are on the scene at that end. They've got the highway sealed off. Neither department has a sharpshooter. The sheriff's detective has been trying to make contact with the bad guys, but they aren't answering the phone or responding to the bullhorn. This is connected to what's going on in PA, isn't it? These guys are Russians.
Could be. We need to reconnoiter the site and make sure.
Is that a good idea? Wouldn't it put the hostages in even more danger?
Like you said, they could be dead already. We know what we're doing. We are not going to screw up. I'll take Jack and head down the bay side of the highway along the shoulder. We'll try to draw fire from the shooters and keep them occupied. Paul and Gadgets, you take the other side of the highway. Keep close to the buildings and stay out of sight of the hostiles. When we flew over down there, I saw a creek bed that dumps into the bay. It crosses under the highway near that little espresso stand. Jump down into the creek and follow it behind the cafe. Paul, see if you can get close enough to the restaurant's back door to use the tactical video audio system to peek inside. We need hard info on the number of hostiles, the number of hostages, and the location of the bioweapon, if it's really there. But don't go kicking down any doors until I give the word. Gadgets, you keep following the creek. Swing around past the end of the building and hook up with the sheriffs on the highway on the other side. There's some high ground on the slope where the motel is. It should give you a good shot angle with the Barrett. Find your hide and wait for my signal to fire at will.
And what if these guys do have more of the damn bioweapon stashed inside?
Bear said the glass vials would be in a well-padded case, a backpack, or a suitcase. We've got to separate it from the hostiles before they can use it.
But we can't just blow them out of their socks. They're our only source of intel on the mission's primary targets, and the number of Spetsnaz still running around.
We can blow all but one of them out of their socks.
That's walking a mighty fine line. These guys aren't going to shoot to wound. They're going to shoot to kill. If one of the glass vials breaks while we're inside that restaurant, we've had it, and so have all the hostages. Better us than half of Seattle. Better it all ends right here. Based on what Spetsnaz has done so far today, we're the hostages' only chance. Here are the priorities, so we're all on the same page. Get control of the bioweapon, even if it means killing every one of the hostage takers. Wound targets if you can, but make sure you put them down hard. Are you in radio contact with the sheriffs and PD?
Yeah.
Tell them DHS is coming their way on a search and destroy. Four guys in black uniforms with weapons, moving down the hill from the north. Tell them not to shoot at us. Don't return fire at the cafe either. Even if the hostiles open up on us, stand down and let us handle it. Got that?
Got it.
Able Team broke out its weaponry, donned combat vests and communication headpieces.
I want to go along with you guys.
Sorry, Trooper. That just isn't going to happen. You're way undergunned for this op. Besides, someone has to handle the civilians up here. That someone is you.
I feel like I owe the bastards down there something personal.
You already dodged the Reaper once today. Best not stretch your luck, son.
Don't worry about the payback.
Schwartz slung the massive, scoped 50 caliber rifle onto his shoulder.
We've got that covered.
Lyons shrugged into the shoulder leather and snugged his .357 Colt Python into his left armpit. As he checked the mag on an H&K MP5 SD3 machine pistol, Grimaldi did likewise on an M16 carbine. The H&K had a fat blue steel sound suppressor threaded onto the muzzle.
Lyons made sure the seal was nice and tight. From years of experience in close-quarters hostage situations, he knew a sound suppressor could mean the difference between success and failure. An unsuspecting enemy was a vulnerable enemy. A suppressor offered an opportunity for multiple kill shots.
Let's do this.
Lyons waved Blunkenellis and Schwartz across the road. Blunkenellis took the lead, carrying another silenced HNK machine pistol. Burdened with 25 pounds of Barrett rifle, plus its extra loaded mags, Schwartz kept his hands free and his Beretta 93R clipped into its hip holster. Pahl and gadgets, Lyons knew, had a lot more room to work with on the landward side of the highway. The commercial buildings sat on a wide, flat spot chopped from the forested hillside and backfilled out of the bay's intertidal zone. They slipped behind the rear of the first structure, the chainsaw sculptor's roadside workshop and gallery, and disappeared from Lyons' view. On Lyons' side of the road, the shoulder dropped off sheer to the left. Below, there was a small, circular, mucky-looking tidal flat. On its outer edge stood a shambling, mostly imploded wooden structure. The decrepit warehouse collapsed across an abandoned railroad line running along the bay's perimeter. Lyons took the point, staying low and moving fast. He led Grimaldi on a weaving path through the line of ditched cars and trucks, trying as much as possible to keep auto bodies and engine blocks between them and the restaurant downrange. As they descended, he and Grimaldi quickly checked the insides of the vehicles for survivors, popping the doors when they could get them open, peeking over the windowsills when they couldn't. The front ends of some of the smaller cars looked like accordions from chain reaction collisions. In some cases, the airbags were deployed. They didn't start finding bodies until they were almost all the way down the grade. There were dead people on the ground between the vehicles, apparently shot from behind as they tried to run away. And there were dead people inside the burning wrecks. A few of the victims were still belted into their car seats, their charred remains enveloped in flame. Lyons and Grimaldi moved rapidly through the billowing heat and pall of caustic smoke. The ABLE team leader crouched beside the slider door of a metallic red Chrysler minivan. The windows were tinted so dark he couldn't see inside.
Anybody in there?
Oh God, please help us.
Lyons found himself staring into the terrified, bloodied face of a brunette woman in her early 30s. She was clutching her blonde son, aged 4 or 5, tight to her chest, protecting him with both her arms. They sat hunkered on the floor of the van between the front bucket and rear bench seats. The blood was coming from her nose. It looked bruised and broken.
Are either of you badly hurt?
No, but my husband, in the front. I couldn't leave him. He's been shot. I don't know what to do.
Easy now, ma'am. Just let us help you.
Lyons pulled the slider all the way open. Grimaldi tried the driver door, but the collision with the car in front pinned it shut. Lyons climbed into the rear compartment, alongside the woman and child. The minivan's driver lay on his side across the console, his head toward the passenger seat. His safety belt was still attached. His breathing was faint, but he was alive.
Oh, please, be careful. Please, be careful. Oh, God. I don't know what to do.
We'll be careful, ma'am, but you've got to calm down.
Lyons stuck his head between the front seats. Both front airbags had popped and deflated. Bullet holes pocked the corner of the passenger side of the windshield. From the low entry angle, the Russian walked up the middle of the road, pot shooting anyone he could see.
Jack, help them out of the van. I need some room to work back here.
You won't make me leave him. Please, don't make me leave him.
No, ma'am. We won't do that, but my partner needs some room to move in there. Let's get you and your son to the side here, in better cover.
As Grimaldi assisted the woman and child out the door, Lyons' serrated SOG auto clip made short work of the safety belt. As carefully as he could, he dragged the unconscious man between the bucket seats and onto the carpeted rear deck. When Lyons rolled the guy over onto his back, he saw the front of his shirt was soaked with wet blood, and there was a bullet hole just below his collarbone on the right side. There was no exit wound out his back. The windshield absorbed some of the round's momentum. The driver was in shock, his face and lips dead white. Lyons used his multi-tool to hack long strips from a polyester baby blanket lying on the rear seat. As he shoved a stuffed toy, a droopy-eared red-and-white puppy dog, against the entry wound and lashed it in place, Grimaldi reappeared at the slider doorway.
We've got to get this guy up the hill. Do you think you can carry him? No problem. But there aren't any ambulances up that way. No medics, no nothing. His wound calls for more than basic first aid. No telling what the Russian tumbler cut through. He could be bleeding out internally. Get him up the hill and fly him out. Anybody else in bad shape, get them out too. There are ambulances and EMTs to the south, behind the police barricade.
Lyons helped Grimaldi shift the wounded man to the edge of the slider doorway. Then the pilot hoisted him over his shoulder in a fireman's carry. Grimaldi straightened and turned for the rear of the van. At 1,000 yards, the Stony Man Warriors and their charges were well outside the accurate range of an AKS-74U. The burst of autofire spanned 15 feet, a tight shot group with an 8-inch barrel at that distance. Lyons guessed the shooter had to have caught the movement beside the vehicle. Someone was watching the roadblock upgrade with high-power binocs or a spotting scope. Returning covering fire for the family and Grimaldi was out of the question. The targets were too far away for his machine pistol, and because their position was as yet unidentified, Jack's M16 wouldn't work either. Anything less than precisely aimed fire would put the restaurant's hostages at risk.
Get going! Stay low!
Lyons took the only course of action available to him. He gave the Russians something else to shoot at, an easy target. Fully upright, in clear view of the cafe, he jogged along the highway's shoulder. Lyons was playing the odds. At a range of nearly a mile, hitting a stationary target, even with a scoped 74 stubby, was almost impossible. Hitting a moving target was impossible. There was an obvious downside to the strategy. He was running the wrong way, running into enemy fire, and he knew it. The closer he got, the better the accuracy, guaranteed. The gunfire stopped. Lyons ran for all he was worth. He put 100 yards behind him, dashing across the Bayside flatland without drawing another response from the Spetsnaz. He knew what they were waiting for, and he was giving it to them, teeth clenched, arms pumping. More than one auto weapon was cutting loose. The shooters at the restaurant were combining fire, trying to bracket him, to force him to run headlong toward them. Lyons broke hard left, cutting across the gravel shoulder, away from the highway, and onto the kiddie train's wide parking lot apron. There were no cars parked out front, and there was no cover until he got through the hurricane-fenced enclosure. At least the gate was standing open. Lyons dived behind the unmanned cotton candy and peanut stand. The kiddie park was in line of sight from Large Marge's front windows. The bend in Highway 101 put the five-car train broadside to the cafe. Before the Spetsnaz could zero in, he darted beneath the old-time passenger cars, all painted unlikely colors. They glow yellow, green, and orange. They sat on a short stretch of track, an artifact of the abandoned railroad. Lyons scrambled out from under the far side and got behind a massive solid steel carriage wheel. An incoming round slammed into the train rail the instant he cleared it. A miracle shot with a 74 stubby, but the force of impact sounded different. Lyons got on his headset.
Gadgets, did you hear that?
Yeah, I thought that last impact sounded different.
Definitely a long gun working.
Or the pro at the other end of it. Let's not give him any sucker shots.
Deal!
As they approached the peeling, lime-green-painted Quonset hut, Schwartz unholstered his 9mm Beretta, dropped the thumb safety, and flipped the fire selector to three-round burst. When Blancanellis went through the fish market's back door with his machine pistol up and ready, Schwartz followed. The shop had a polished concrete slab floor, crazed with cracks. Over the sights of the 93R, the only living things Schwartz could see were the Dungeness crabs, Hood Canal oysters, and clams in glass-walled, aerated tanks. The shop reeked of bleach and iodine. The silent portable TV above the service counter was still on, tuned to breaking news from Port Angeles. The Discovery Bay fishmonger evidently hightailed it over the hills. They retraced their route out the back door, exited the market, and headed for the rear of the second-hand store, about 100 feet away.
Hear that engine? Maybe someone's trying to make a getaway.
Trotting to the near wall of the second-hand store, they high-load around the corner. Schwartz went high with the Beretta, Blancanellis low with the H&K. Two sets of gun sights swept over the waste ground behind the junk shop. A dented, gray-primered, full-sized Chevy pickup truck was nose-first into the crumbling bluff, smoke puffing steadily out of its tailpipe. No driver was in evidence in the cab. The two men approached the driver and passenger doors from the rear, weapons up and ready to rip. Through the open side windows, the truck's dashboard was visible. It was covered with heaps of fast food refuse, yellowed newspaper, empty pop cans, candy wrappers, and cigarette packs, all held in place by a pair of greasy pipe wrenches. Dirt from the face of the bluff showered down on the hood, grill, and bumper, adding to the load already deposited there.
I think it's still in gear!
Holding the Beretta aimed at the center of the driver door, he peeked over the top of the windowsill. A man lay sideways on the blanket-covered bench seat. He wore a red do-rag and bib-front jeans. He had long, grizzled hair and a ratty-looking beard. There was a round hole in his left temple.
He didn't get far.
Schwartz reached in through the window, turned the ignition key, and killed the engine. A heavy-caliber Dragunov round sailed toward the kiddie park and Carl Lyons.
Dragunov?
Could be.
The one barista 8x8-foot portable espresso stand was deserted, the back door ajar. Behind it, a creek fed into a corrugated metal culvert under the two-lane highway. A trickle of water flowed through it. The stream bed ran perpendicular to the road until it reached the foot of the hillside to the right. Then it bent around to the left, running behind the cafe. The roof gables of large marges could just barely be seen over the top of the wall of scrub alder, devil's club, and blackberry bushes that sprouted high along the bank. The two able team commandos eased down into a narrow gully, which quickly became a tunnel of backlit, overarching branches. A tunnel roughly 5 feet high. Both men had to hunch over. Schwartz holstered his Beretta and unslung the Barrett to keep the muzzle brake from dragging across the undersides of the branches. When they reached the bend in the bed, they saw another, smaller culvert, which directed a feeder creek coming off the hillside into the larger channel. It was only about 3 feet in diameter, big enough to hide someone. Moving as quietly as possible, the two men approached the pipe.